Have you ever found yourself completely helpless? At a point where you realized that there was nothing within yourself that could possibly change what seemed to be completely inevitable, defeated. I'm sure there's more than a few guys in this room that think I'm talking about the 3-on-3 tournament a few weeks ago. And that would be an apt illustration. I've watched that ball go up in my dreams many times. And athletics are, the sports are probably one of the greatest illustrations for something like this. When it comes right down to it, we've all been there. Anybody that's ever played a sport or done anything competitive has found themselves at a place where they could not, no matter how hard they tried, change what was going to happen. They see the scoreboard, they knew what was happening, they saw the inevitable. And despite their greatest efforts, it just wasn't going to change it. But for me, there was a moment that was maybe more serious that has really solidified this in my life. It was a defining moment in my world. I was about 8 years old. I remember distinctly waking up in the middle of the night that night, gasping for breath, just wanting nothing more than to be able to take one deep breath, and it's terrifying. For anybody in the room that has ever experienced an asthma attack, either firsthand or the loved one, it's scary. And I remember thinking to myself, there's nothing I can do. This night, this wasn't the first asthma attack I'd ever had. This, in fact, was one that I kind of just thought would happen as it normally does. Mom would come with the inhaler. I would take a few puffs. Everything was going to be okay. But there were a few things different about that night, the first of which I realized very quickly was that my door was locked. I didn't even know the doors locked in those old farmhouses with the skeleton key locks. But it was. And the guy that my mom and I were living with at the time kicked the door off the hinges. It was a hectic and chaotic moment. As I'm just trying to get some breath, and she comes in, and there's the inhaler, and I remember taking puffs of it and thinking to myself, this will fix it, but it didn't. Something was different, but that wasn't the first time that ever happened either, and she asked me the question that she'd asked before, and it was, can you make it? And I knew what that meant. I knew that when she asked, could you make it, that meant, could you make it to the hospital, or do we need to call an ambulance? And at 8 years old, I got to admit to you, I was fairly aware of the cost of an ambulance. I said, yeah, I can make it. Halfway down the driveway, I realized that I could not make it. And she slammed on the brakes, and back down the driveway we went, and she called the ambulance. And we lived in a town kind of like Buckley. It was just a little too far away from the local hospital, and it took them a while to get there. It was probably 20 minutes or more. When they arrived, they hooked me up to the oxygen, and for the first time in probably close to an hour, I started to be able to breathe again. I would spend the next 3 weeks in an oxygen tent. I would miss a significant amount of school, but in that oxygen tent, I learned something. One, I learned that I did not like nurses. 3 a.m., they felt like it was a great time to turn me over, prod me, take my temperature, whatever else. And I also learned that when you are completely surrounded by 100% pure oxygen, that even when you're gasping, when you're desperate for air, even the slightest little breath is enough. It was a terrifying moment. It really was. But I will be perfectly honest with you, 30-plus years later, I remember the fear that I felt, and I can't imagine that what my mom felt that day. The helplessness. And there are others in our community, in our congregation, that have felt this. They're feeling this now, and my prayers go out to them because the desperation of feeling helpless, it is a difficult time. And it tends to be a defining moment for most of us. I know it was for me, and that defining moment typically takes us one of two directions. For many of us in this room, we remember a moment of pure helplessness that drove us into the arms of Jesus. We didn't have anywhere else to go. But there are still others maybe you, that moment of desperation drove you as far away from him as you could possibly go. Maybe you pointed the finger, maybe you blamed him. I'm not really sure why we do it, but I know I have. But the thing that I know for sure is in those moments when we start to recognize we are not in control and nothing within us is enough, we have to find something else. Tonight, we're going to pick up scripture in John chapter 15. If you want to open to that, go ahead. We will read the last of the I am statements that Jesus makes. So over the course of the last month or so, too, probably, we've studied several different statements that Jesus says that I am. And this one's a little different. This isn't quite as dramatic as I am the resurrection and the life. This isn't quite as famous as I am the way, the truth, and the life. This is one that's very particular. And in that time, it would have been common to most everybody. Because then most people made their living or at least found their food through some form of gardening. So for us today, we pick up in John chapter 15, where Jesus says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes, that it may bear more fruit. Already you are clean because of the word that I have spoken to you. Abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. Whoever abides in me and I in him, he it is that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. It ends heavy as Jesus reminds us what I learned at 8 years old, that outside of him, we just don't have enough in us. But that isn't all he's telling. This illustration that Jesus gives is packed full of lessons for us, and I think 2,000 years later, it's just as accurate for us today. I'll go as far as to say, I don't know for sure if any of it is applicable for you, but as I read this passage over and over and over again over the last several weeks, it was 100% applicable to me. And I'll encourage you that over the course of the next couple of weeks or next couple of days until Easter, if you're looking for something to do to dive in, read the rest of this chapter. Read it over and over again because it has so much to offer us. But it starts simple enough. I am the vine. Jesus is telling us that Jesus is the vine. So the gardening analogy is simple, that Jesus is the vine, his Father is the vine dresser or the gardener. That means for us, the application piece is very simple. That outside of Jesus, we get nothing the Father is giving us. So the idea is that God, the Father, gives us everything good. The book of James says it this way. He says, every good and perfect thing comes down from the Father of heavenly lights. Our God gives us everything that we need. So whether it's water, fertilizer, nutrients, God is the gardener. And Jesus is the vine which everything funnels through to get to us, the branches. It's very straightforward. There's literally nothing that gets to the branches that doesn't come through the vine. Therefore, without Jesus, we get nothing good at all. Because when we begin to understand who God is and his very nature, we begin to understand that God is everything that is good. And there are some in the room, maybe you're not a believer, maybe this is your first time at church. Welcome, I'm glad that you're here. But the truth is, and I think that we'll see this as we continue on, nothing that we think is good apart from God is really good. It might be short-lived and entertaining, but it's not good. And it certainly has no eternal value. See, Jesus is expressing to us something that most of us that have been around for a while, and some of you that have been around far longer than I have had to learn the hard way, that no matter what we look to in this life, it will always let us down. See, the implication is, if Jesus is the true vine, there must be false vines, right? So what are these false vines? Well, if you've been around church for a few minutes, you probably heard a sermon or two that have mentioned them. Some of them are really simple. Some of them are the things that we identify right off the bat. Addiction, drugs and alcohol. It's a false vine. We go to it thinking that we're going to get something good from it. What we actually get from it is false fruit. Something that makes us maybe happy in the moment and leaves us empty at the end of the day. And I look around the room and I can see brothers and sisters, my friends, people that have lived a similar life to what I have, and they recognize that more than most people understand, that no matter how deep you go into the bottle, no matter how many of the pills you take, no matter how much of it you smoke, it'll always leave you empty. It is false fruit. That's the easy one. See, there are some that are less insidious, like wealth. There's nothing wrong with money. And let me be clear about that. There is nothing in and of itself wrong with money. Money is not evil. It is the root of many kinds of evil. Go read that scripture again. It doesn't say what some people think it does. But wealth is a false vine when we start to begin to think that if we latch onto it, if we make a little bit more, everything will be okay. And this one hits home for most of us because at some point we have sought security on this earth in how much money we can make so that we'll be okay. And I'm just going to say it. For those of you in here that are like, doesn't apply to me, I only make like $24,000 a year. It still applies to you. We start to think that the only people that are ever lured away by wealth are the wealthy. Man, when I was dirt poor, the only thing I thought about was having more money. It became the one thing I thought that if I could connect myself to enough money, everything would be okay. It's a lie. It'll leave you stressed out because there will never be enough of it no matter what. Find the richest guy you know. Ask him the question. He'll admit it. It's a false vine and it produces false fruit that is stress and shame and not good enough. Some of them are even more dastardly. Charity, giving. Giving to the needy. There can be nothing wrong with giving to the needy. God even calls us to do it, right? Yep. But when we find our identity in it, when it is the most important thing, when that warm, fuzzy feeling we get when we give becomes what we want to identify ourselves as, it becomes a false vine and it produces the false fruit of pride. Maybe one of the ugliest. I don't know a lot of rich people. Maybe I do, and they're just humble rich people and they're not all bad, but Scripture has a lot to say about wealth. And we get warned because it will produce false fruit. And these last two are probably even harder to hear. See, I think that a false vine can be our significant other, our spouse, our girlfriend, our boyfriend. Come on, guys, it's really easy to see it in our young people, isn't it? They are certain that that person that they love will give them everything they've ever wanted, and then they'll be happy. We're no better. We're just older, doing the same thing, expecting our spouse somehow to make us happy. They were never meant to make you happy. They were never meant to make you perfect. You were meant to make them happy. No, that's not true either. It's a false vine when we allow it to become something that we think that if we connect to, and I'll just be honest with you, if my wife is waiting for me to someday attain the level to where she can just latch on to me and I will give her joy, she will be waiting a while. And as amazing as she is, I would never want to do that to her. How much pressure, how unfair is that to make your spouse Jesus? What about kids? Do we make our kids our vine? Sometimes. You ever been to a sporting event and that parent behind you is losing their ever-loving mind? Because they're living their entire life vicariously through that child on the court. Do you know how much pressure that must be? I got to win this game for me and the old man. That's not fair to them. We've made them a vine. And here's the worst part, is that kind of false fruit, that rotten fruit, that continues generation after generation, and it just corrupts and destroys because nobody can live up to it. And then we find ourselves, kids 10 years old, lost a game, shame. How dare we make our children the vine? Jesus is the true vine. He's the only true vine. And God has strong words for us, for those of us that either choose to not be connected to the vine or to be connected to the wrong vines. He says that those will be the branches that he cuts away. So I want to be cautious here because there may be somebody that wandered into a Good Friday service tonight and they're going, I don't even know about this Jesus you're talking about, but this sounds intense. He's going to cut me away and throw me. What kind of amazing love must our God have for us to give us a choice? We get to choose whether or not we want to be connected to, what we want to be connected to. So for some of us in this room, we'll leave those doors tonight and we'll go back to the same false vine we've always gone to. And I don't want you to feel shame. This is not a guilt trip. This is a reminder that God gave you that choice. See, sometimes I forget that I am 100% without question fully dependent on God. He allows me the choices I make. So if you're there, I'd invite you to consider who this Jesus is, what this vine looks like, what it could be to be connected to the vine that connects us to God the Father. That is a powerful, powerful consideration on this Easter weekend. But for those of us that do know God, he has equally difficult words for. Some of you caught it as I was going through, that word pruning. See, it speaks of, and somebody caught me after the last service to explain to me just what it looks like. He said, sometimes you look at a tree that's been pruned and it looks like it's been cut so far down that it's dead. It's because there was much false fruit on that tree and it had to cut away. God takes time to cut away the false fruit that is on me, the bitterness, the stress, the envy, the jealousy, the pride. And it hurts. It hurts bad when he cuts. Sometimes because I'm clinging a hold of it because I desperately want it because at one point I thought it would bring me something good. And even now I can't just let it go. I don't know if that's hard for anybody else, but the pruning is terrifying to me. And I know that the Father that loves me desperately will leave nothing left that is sin and wicked in me. He is going to continue to prune us so that we will bear much fruit. Are you ready to be pruned? Are we as a church ready to be pruned? It's not easy. But he does it so that we can produce fruit. And verse 3 is interesting. Just in case, I don't want to belabor this, but I want to make sure that we don't get confused that this pruning is not a salvation issue. This does not mean that because you've got some false fruit on you that you can't meet God one day, that that confession you made of Jesus Christ was somehow not real. That's not the case. And I know this because in verse 3 says this. He says, already you are clean because of the word that I have spoken to you. See, Jesus is reminding us in this very simple, like he breaks the continuity of this paragraph up to make sure that we understand. You're already clean because you know me. He's talking to his disciples here and he's telling them without question, you know me, you are already clean. This isn't about that, guys. This is about living a joy-filled, fruitful life, a productive Christian life. Is there anybody in this room that would desire to live a fruitful, productive Christian life beyond what they are today? I know I would. And he's not telling us that he's got to cut it away so that we meet him. He's telling us that he's got to cut it away so that we can produce fruit. So what is fruit? Well, some of you, if you've been around church a while, you probably go to the parable in the book of Matthew of the sower. It's familiar to many of us, not everybody. But it's a parable where we're told that if the seed is planted on good ground, then we will produce a fruitful crop of 30, 60, even 100 fold. And we're like, awesome. So if I'm fruitful, if I do this right, if I let him prune it off, then I will produce a bunch of new disciples and everybody will come to Jesus that I know. Awesome. But that isn't what our experience has been, is it? Somehow we're doing our best to let God prune us, and there's not all this fruit yet. We're not sure why. We think maybe something's broken. Well, I think maybe it's because we missed a piece of the puzzle. That God prunes us so that we produce good fruit, but that fruit isn't immediately the harvest. That fruit begins with the fruit of the Spirit. Now, if my good friend Ben Brown was up here, he could recite all nine of them. I'll do my best, but here's the thing. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, gentleness, faithfulness, goodness, self-control. I think I got him. I was channeling Ben. That is the fruit that God is asking us to begin to produce. Imagine, church, if we produce that in our daily lives. Imagine if we produce that in our marriage. Patience in our marriage. Novel concept. Imagine if we sowed the entire world those simple fruits. We let God cut away the false fruit from us. And we instead showed love and joy and peace and goodness to the people around us. That, my friends, is how I think we see the 30, 60, and 100-fold. Because when people see that, they're desperate for it. They want nothing more than to come and be close to the kindness, the gentleness, the love. Patience is so rare today, isn't it? Friends, I think the fruit that he's calling us to produce, the pruning that he does in us, is those simple things. And when we do that, all the other things in life start to fall together. See, Jesus gives us what God is offering us. And it says later in this chapter, again, read it yourself. In verse 11, it says, that your joy may be full. He's telling us this so that our joy may be full. You know what I'm certain of? That if I produce those nine things, love, joy, peace, patience, and all those, my wife's life would be better. If we as a church produce those things, the lives of the people around us would be better. There would be more joy to go around. But somehow we get so stuck on this idea that we think the coming part to Jesus is the only part of it, but he's calling us to do something different. And I think that we can get really caught up here and we can mess things up if we're not careful, because all of a sudden we go, I just got to make myself be more patient. I don't know how to do that. I've spent 11 years with children trying to figure out how to be more patient. I can't do it. See, I think the fruit analogy comes back to us and reminds us that fruit doesn't try harder to grow, does it? Have you ever seen an apple on a tree just shaking with everything it's got to grow? Me either. It simply remains. Just hangs there and receives what the vine gives it. I think we're being told to remain in Jesus. See, many of us, we're only really connected to Jesus by a one-time statement, one-time prayer that we made. Maybe we're 14 years old, and maybe a quarterly visit to the church on the weekend. That's our only real connection to who Jesus is. And we wonder why we're not producing fruit in our lives. It's because Jesus didn't just call us to follow. He didn't just say, come with me. He said, abide with me. And that word abide, we toyed with whether or not to use the word abide or remain, but abide is a word we don't use much, and it has a deep, deep meaning. The Greek is menos, and what it alludes to is this idea of being wholly connected and remaining wholly connected, engulfed and overwhelmed by. The only thing, the only example I can give you of it is when I was 8 years old in that oxygen tent, completely engulfed in pure oxygen. And able to breathe to the depth of the end of my lungs for the first time. That, I think, is what it feels like to abide. To be completely surrounded by and wholly connected to Jesus. I can't tell you what it looks like for you. I wish I could. There is scripture that helps us. If you want to turn with or jot down, in 1 John chapter 2, there are a couple of verses that I think help us understand this idea of remaining in Jesus, of abiding in Jesus. In verse 17, it says it this way. And the world is passing away along with its desires. That's all the false vines. But whoever does the will of God abides forever. He's talking about eternity. He's talking about forever. When we do the will of God, we abide forever. We remain in Jesus, wholly connected and overwhelmed by his love forever. In verse 6, he says this. Whoever says he abides in him ought to walk in the same way in which he walked. He's talking about Jesus. We're supposed to walk the same path that Jesus walked. And on this Good Friday, that is a difficult pill to swallow. The idea that we're going to walk the same path that Jesus walked. In my life, the idea of remaining in Jesus, of abiding in Jesus, is something that is almost overwhelming to me. I asked my son, I asked a lot of people actually, what this word abide means. And I'm going to give you the 8-year-old definition of it, because I think he's brilliant. You don't have to, he's my kid, but he is, so whatever. He said it this way, he said, I know that I am completely dependent on God, because without him, I wouldn't even be created. Well, that's simple enough. So do we act like that? Do we actually act as if the God of the universe that loved us desperately enough to give us whatever choice we wanted, that this is the God who created us? Do we follow in his footsteps? Do we do his will? What does that look like? Well, I can't tell you for you, but I can tell you for me. On the moments, the rare few moments where I feel really connected to Jesus, where I can feel the Spirit of God moving, there are a few things that I see that are consistent. One, I'm typically on my knees in prayer. I am broken. Have you ever noticed that it's the hardest moments in life that break you, that drive you to your knees, that you see God the clearest? Maybe it's just me. But there are times where I'm in praise, where I'm grateful to God, where maybe I've come out of that moment and I can see clearly for the first time. See, one of the other lessons I learned with that oxygen tent was every breath is really precious to me now. I was told I'd never play sports. I love sports. I'm bad at them, but I really enjoy them. And I value every breath I take. Do we live our lives as if every breath we take was given to us as a gift from the Creator of the universe? For me, that's what it looks like to abide in him. In those mundane moments of the life, every now and again, he taps me on the shoulder and I hear him. I can feel him. I know he's there because I'm connected. And it's typically because of this book. I've opened it. I've read something. It has opened something in my mind that has allowed me to consider the way that I live or the people in my world. And lastly, maybe the simplest, is when I'm around people who I know God is present in. I look around this room and I would love to just go through and start saying names of the people that I've met here that have drawn me closer to who Jesus is, that have connected me more to the vine. Thank you. Thank you for those of you that pray for me, for us as a church. That connects me to who Jesus is, and it reminds me of his presence, and it allows me, even if for a moment, to reflect on who he really is in my life. I've heard it said that the fruitfulness of a church is determined by its intentional practice of abiding in the vine. And its barrenness is most often prayerless busyness. Does busyness ever disconnect you from God? Probably just me again. I know that when I read that verse and it tells me that we should follow in the way that Jesus walked, that as hard as that is to hear, knowing what happened to him on that Good Friday 2,000 years ago, that I can look at what he chose to do in that moment and guess that because I happen to live here in this great country, that I probably won't face the same end that he did for my faith. But it doesn't change what we can learn from what he did that day. Because Jesus, in his darkest moment, stayed connected to the Father. We know this because in the Garden of Gethsemane, he went and he prayed 3 times. He cried out to God and he asked him to take the cup from him. Hey, don't make me do this, God. That's the Martin translation. I apologize if that's heretical. He cried out to God while he was hung on that cross. Through the tears and the pain and the mockery of the people there, he cried out to God on our behalf. He said, "Forgive them. They know not what they do." And I'm not one to question God, but sometimes I wonder because I feel like I know what I'm doing and I still do it, and he was praying for me. And I am so grateful that in those moments, in his darkest moment, he was connected to the Father enough to pray for me and for you. And that is why we get what he offered us in eternity. He cried out another time, and maybe it's the only time in all of history where Jesus was disconnected from God even for a moment. And I don't really understand this fully, so afterward you can ask me and I'll tell you I don't fully get it. But what I do know is in the last moments of his life, we read that he said this phrase, "Eli, Eli, lama sabachthani." And it meant, "Lord, will you take this from me?" And in that moment, whether he was disconnected or not, he was desperate to be connected to his Father. He was desperate for us when he prayed for us. He was desperate for God in that moment. He wanted to do the will of his Father, even to the point of death. And that's why we're here today, 2,000 years later, to celebrate. "Why have you forsaken me?" were the words that he used. And they confused me. They still do. But what I know for sure is that that is the vine, our only connection to God the Father, who prayed that for you and for me, showing us what it looks like to be wholly connected to God. So my question for us tonight, what does it look like for us as a church? What does it look like for you individually to not profess to simply be a believer, but to be wholly connected to the vine so that God can continue to prune you and you can begin to produce good fruit? As Victoria comes out, we will sing another song and I will ask you to remain seated. To remain in Jesus, to pray, to consider, to contemplate, to reflect, whatever you want to call it. What is God calling you tonight? To remain in him. What does that look like? And what does the world look like if we choose to do that tomorrow? After this song, we will celebrate communion together. So I would ask you to remain here for as long as appropriate.